Welcome to today's The Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, December 24th. Happy Christmas Eve. I'm your reader, Wanda. Here is our first story. COVID-19 vaccinations continue in Pottawatomie County. Vaccine Day in Pottawatomie County. On Wednesday, COVID-19 vaccinations continued in the area with Methodist Jenny Edmondson Hospital, All Care Health Center, and Pottawatomie County Public Health doling out their first doses. CHI Health Mercy Council Bluffs started vaccinating nurses on Tuesday. "I feel a sense of help and a sense of relief," Dr. Sumit Mukherjee, pulmonary critical care physician and medical director of the intensive care unit at Jenny Edmondson, said after being among the first to receive the Moderna shot at the hospital. "This has been a big step. To have this now gives us the motivation to keep pushing and keep fighting. I'm just very hopeful and excited." Intensive care nurse Kelly Race said, "It's a new day and it's a new beginning for all of us." Race said she hopes the vaccine will bring a decline in the number of critically ill COVID-19 patients that pass through the ICU. "The hospital has seen countless days of full capacity in the unit. It's been a losing battle more times than not. It's been very stressful," she said, describing the recovery process as a long one. The hospital received 400 doses, which will be administered over the next few weeks. Mukherjee said he stepped up to be vaccinated and thinks it's important others do so as well for a number of reasons. "Part of my why, in addition to my family, community, co-workers, and patients, is that science is science and medicine," he said. The physician said he trusts the vaccine. He noted that while brought to market quickly, it's gone through the appropriate steps and criteria for safety and efficacy. The Food and Drug Administration issued an emergency use authorization for the Moderna vaccine on December 18. The Pfizer BioNTech has previously been approved through an emergency use authorization by the FDA. Both vaccines require two doses, with Moderna's 28 days apart and Pfizer's 21 days apart. "It's something I believe in strongly," Mukherjee said. "That's why I wanted to take the vaccine as soon as possible." At the Mid-American Center, Pottawatomie County Health staff, along with an assist from employees from other departments, hosted a vaccination clinic for first responders with the Council Bluffs Fire Department and volunteer departments in the city, in the county, along with health clinics not attached to the large health systems in the area and school nurses. The county will disperse 400 doses during clinics Wednesday and today at the MAC and at Oakland Clinic held Wednesday night. "It was nerve-wracking, lots of planning and preparation," Public Health Director Matt Wyant said. "I'm glad it's here. It's exciting." At the clinic, attendees with appointments first go through a triage area to ensure they're eligible for the vaccine. Wyant noted among the reasons a person might need to consult their physician before being vaccinated included allergies, if the person is on blood thinners, if they're pregnant or nursing, and if they're immunocompromised. "Then it's time for the shot." "Easy peasy," Teresa Tenner of Minden said afterwards. "No problem. You even get a sucker afterward." Tenner is a member of the Minden Volunteer Fire Department and also the town's city clerk. "We need this to be over with. The doctors are saying it's safe. It's safe. The sooner more people get it, the better," Tenner said. Claudia Barajas, a nurse at Grifols Plasma Clinic in Council Bluffs said she came to the MAC to protect everybody, to protect myself, protect everybody I work with, protect my family. Finally, a light at the end of the tunnel, she said. This won't be the end, but at least we can see it's coming to an end point, and we can start moving forward with our lives. All Care Health received 100 doses and hopes to have all willing employees vaccinated by the end of next week. It's a good first step to get ahead of this, said Margarita Hawkins, a technician at the clinic's Test Iowa site. I'm hoping a lot more people get vaccinated. It's the responsible thing to do. All Care's co-medical director, Teresa Dowling, who is a nurse practitioner, said, as a primary care provider, I'm always telling people to do what they can to prevent illness and disease. This is my chance to practice what I preach. All Care has been a Test Iowa site since July and has provided COVID-19 tests through the clinic longer than that. Dowling said it's great to reach this milestone. As vaccinations continue, Wyant said, significantly less vaccine is coming to the county next week, with those doses going to rural health systems. Wyant said the county will find out more about its next allotment on Monday. After the holidays, the county will hold additional clinics at the MAC. Right now, Pottawatomie County and other counties in the area are receiving only the Moderna vaccine. The Pfizer vaccine requires extreme cold storage conditions. Wyant said the county had set up storage with partners in Nebraska, but Iowa didn't allow that. Asked if the inability to take on the Pfizer vaccine impacts how many doses reach the county, Wyant said it's something he's asked the state about. The first doses of Pfizer went out to everyone else in the state but us. Then we got our allotment of Moderna. Then we see our allotment of Moderna cut by so much, Wyant said. The state vaccine distribution plan called for allotments based on population. Right now, they're not showing that as equitable across the state, Wyant said. A message to the Iowa Department of Public Health seeking clarification wasn't immediately returned. Vaccinations are first going to healthcare workers, first responders, and residents and staff at long-term care facilities. Next will come residents 75 years old and older, along with teachers and school staff, food processing workers, and other essential workers before eventually reaching the general population. Mukherjee and Race with Jenny Edmondson said that while the vaccine offers a glimmer of hope, we won't be putting away the masks or stop distancing anytime soon. We have to not get lax in what we have been doing. That won't help our situation. People still need to be safe, take precautions, protect one another, like we have all along, Race said. We need to continuing to push for education and behavioral modifications to prevent the spread, Majerke said. A single shot doesn't mean we take off our masks and go back to normal. We phase into it. So much of this is a sense of community, that we're all in this together. Next article. Pottawatomie County nears 8,000 COVID-19 cases. Pottawatomie County is nearing 8,000 total COVID-19 cases, but has seen its 14-day positivity rate consistently decrease since high points in mid-November. There were 7,959 positive cases out of 38,770 individuals tested, with 6,206 rigs on Wednesday afternoon, according to Iowa Department of Public Health data. There are currently 1,753 active cases. There have been 87 COVID-19 deaths in the county. The county's 14-day positivity rate was 15.8%. That it was at 21.1% on December 1st and a high of 22.7% on November 17th. Though the positivity rate has dropped and vaccinations have started in the area, public health officials continue to encourage residents to follow COVID-19 precautions and guidelines, including social distancing and wearing a mask. Mills County was at 1,242 cases out of 6,469 individuals tested, with 1,047 recoveries on Wednesday, according to IDPH data on the state's COVID-19 website, coronavirus.iowa.gov. There have been 13 deaths in the county. Mills County 14-day positivity rate was 12.5%. Harrison County's 14-day rate remains above 20% and was at 23.4% Wednesday. The county had 1,366 positive cases out of 5,263 individuals tested, with 1,041 recoveries and 52 deaths. The Metro Area Health Care Coalition, which includes the two Council Bluffs hospitals, reported 313 COVID-19 patients, with 90 in intensive care and 44 on ventilators. There were an additional 16 hospitalized patients believed to have COVID-19 awaiting test results. Next article. Relief grants to fuel training at Iowa Western CHI Health. Iowa Western Community College has been awarded $172,700 coronavirus relief registered apprenticeship incentive grant to expand its an existing apprenticeship, while CHI Health Missouri Valley has been awarded a $250,000 grant to develop a certified nursing assistant registered apprenticeship program. The purpose of the grants is to increase the number of registered apprenticeships at post-secondary educational institutions and healthcare employers by providing funds for the purchase of equipment, tools, simulators, curriculum, and other needed items, according to a press release from Iowa Workforce Development. It is also to expand opportunities for Iowans whose jobs have been affected by or eliminated because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Iowa Western will use its grant to create a mobile weld lab to allow critical hands-on training to take place while maintaining proper social distancing. We have a registered apprenticeship with Owens Industries in Carter Lake, said Mark Stanley, Vice President of Economic and Workforce Development at Iowa Western. We do training at Owens Industries, but with the coronavirus pandemic, it makes it harder to get too many students and keep them socially distanced. This was an opportunity for us to create a mobile weld lab, so we can take it to Owen Industries and really increase the capacity for that welding apprenticeship with them. Two welding stations with generators are being mounted on a customized flatbed truck to create an open-air lab, said Starlin Perdue, Director of Economic Development at the college. The work is being done by TI Nick Incorporated of Oakland. The college also purchased a trailer from and H trailers in Clarinda that can be used to haul supplies, including gas canisters, welder tips, etc., produce in. We were able to use local companies, she said. The total cost is expected to be about $152,000. The rest will be spent on supplies, including personal protective equipment. The collaboration between the company and the college on an apprenticeship is in its fifth year, Purdue said. The majority is its hands-on at Owens, adding that part of its classroom learning at Iowa Western. The apprenticeship is based on 144 hours per year for 3 years, but Purdue said the program is accelerated, so the overall length is only 2 years. 4 to 8 students can go through the program at a time, but generally there are only 4 or 5. A mobile weld lab is something that had been on Iowa Western's wish list for a while, but never worked out before, Purdue said. She's confident it will be used well into the future. All of our industries have a welder shortage, she said. CHI Health Missouri Valley will create a new certified nursing assistant registered apprenticeship program to help address the shortage of nurses and nursing assistants. The goal is to develop a program that can attract individuals who will then stay in the area, the press release stated. Next article. Republicans block $2,000 virus checks despite Trump demand. House Republicans shot down a Democratic bid on Thursday to pass President Donald Trump's long shot end of the session demand for $2,000 direct payments to most Americans before signing a long overdue COVID-19 relief bill. The made-for-TV clash came as the Democratic-controlled chamber convened for a pro forma session scheduled in anticipation of a smooth Washington landing for the massive year-end legislative package, which folds together a $1.4 trillion government-wide spending with the hard-fought COVID-19 package and dozens of unrelated but bipartisan bills. Thursday's unusual 12-minute House session instead morphed into unconvincing theater in response to Trump's veto musings about the package, which was negotiated by Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin on Trump's behalf. Representative Steve Hoyer, the number 2 House Democrat, sought the unanimous approval of all House members to pass the bill. But GOP leader Kevin McCarthy, who was not present in the nearly empty chamber, denied his approval and the effort fizzled. If Trump were to follow through on his implied veto threat delivered via video clip on Tuesday, the government would likely experience a brief partial shutdown of the government starting on December 29th. It would also delay delivery of $600 direct payments that the bill does contain. Senate Republicans, led by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, have opposed larger $2,000 checks as too costly and poorly targeted. Democrats are supportive of the direct payments and now plan to vote on the $2,000 check proposal on Monday. House Republicans are expected to block the vote, but Democrats may try again Monday. The president's last-minute objections are setting up a defining showdown with his own Republican Party in his final days in office. Rather than take the victory of the sweeping aid package among the biggest in history, Trump is lashing out at GOP leaders over the presidential election for acknowledging Joe Biden as president-elect and rebuffing his campaign to dispute the Electoral College results when they are tallied in Congress on January 6th. The president's push to increase direct payments for most Americans from $600 to $2,000 for individuals and $4,000 for couples splits the party with a politically painful loyalty test, including for GOP Senators David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler fighting to retain their seats in the January 5th special election in Georgia. Republican lawmakers traditionally balk at big spending, and many never fully embrace Trump's populist approach. Their political DNA tells them to oppose a costlier relief package, but now they're being asked to stand with the president. On a conference call Wednesday, House Republican lawmakers complained that Trump threw them under the bus, according to one Republican on the private call, and granted anonymity to discuss it. Most had voted for the package, and they urged leaders to hit the cable news shows to explain its benefits, the person said. Democrats were taking advantage of Republican disarray to apply pressure for a priority. John Ossoff, Perdue's Democratic opponent, tweeted simply on Tuesday night, $2,000 checks now. The relief bill Trump is criticizing would establish a temporary $300 per week supplemental jobless benefit, along with a new round of subsidies for hard-hit businesses, restaurants, and theaters, and money for schools, healthcare providers, and renters facing eviction. Even though Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin represented the White House in negotiations, Trump assailed the bipartisan effort in a video he tweeted out Tuesday night, suggesting he may not sign the legislation. Railing against a range of provisions in the broader government funding package, including foreign aid mainstays included each year, Trump called the bill a disgrace. Trump did not specifically vow to use his veto power, and there may be enough support in Congress to override him if he does. But the consequences would be severe if Trump upends the legislation. It would mean no federal aid to struggling Americans and small businesses, and no additional resources to help with vaccine distribution. To top it off, because lawmakers linked the pandemic relief bill to an overarching funding measure, the government would shut down on December 29th. The final text of the more than 5,000-page bill was still being prepared by Congress and was not expected to be sent to the White House for Trump's signature before Thursday or Friday, an aide said. That complicates the schedule ahead. If Trump vetoes the package or allows it to expire with a pocket veto at the end of the year, Americans will go without massive amounts of COVID aid. The resolution could be forced Monday. That's when a stopgap funding bill Congress approved to keep the government funded while the paperwork was being compiled expires, risking a federal shutdown. Democrats are considering another stopgap measure to at least keep government running until Biden is sworn into office January 20th, according to two aides granted anonymity to discuss the private talks. The House was already set to return Monday and the Senate Tuesday for a vote to override Trump's veto of the must-pass defense bill. Democrats must try again at that time to pass Trump's proposal for $2,000 checks, as well as the temporary government funding measure to avert a shutdown, the aides said. The push for bigger payments to Americans drew rare common cause between Trump and some of the most liberal members of Congress. Pelosi and Democrats said they fought for the higher stipend during protracted negotiations, only to settle on the lower number when Republicans refuse. Pelosi is set to offer the president's proposal Thursday under a procedure that allows just one lawmaker to object its consideration. It will be pushed forward during a so-called pro forma session, with few lawmakers expected to attend. McCarthy and Republicans are poised to object. Republicans have been reluctant to spend more on pandemic relief and only agreed to the big year-end package as time dwindled for a final deal. Senator Chuck Schumer, the Senate Democratic leader, said that Trump needs to sign the bill to help people and keep the government open, and Congress would step up for more aid after. The Senate cleared the huge relief package by a 92-6 vote after the House approved it by 359-53. Those votes total enough would be enough to override a veto should Trump decide to take that step. Biden applauded lawmakers for their work. He described the package as far from perfect, but it does provide vital relief at a critical time. He also said more relief would be needed in the months ahead. Next story. Man charged with multiple counts of child abuse. A Council Bluffs man faces numerous child abuse charges after police say he physically attacked three children under his care. Leslie Kennedy Sr., 73, faces two counts of child endangerment causing serious injury, one count of domestic abuse by strangulation, and one count of false imprisonment. Court records shows the alleged events happened between January 2017 and this month. He was arrested December 16 and being held in Pottawatomie County Jail on a $20,000 bond. On December 8th, an officer with the Council Bluffs Police Department received information that children were being abused at a home in the 1800 block of Tostevin Street, according to this arrest affidavit. Court records show one minor alleged abuse reported to school officials, to his or her father, and a church pastor that Kennedy recently choked another family member. As a result of an investigation, three children were placed in protective custody on December 10th. One child interviewed at Children's Square disclosed that after making a gingerbread house on a recent day, Kennedy allegedly became upset with two children for making a mess and proceeded to grab one by the back of the neck and strangle the child against a table. Court records show another adult in the house intervened to end the alleged incident. During the course of the investigation, police reported that all three children claimed Kennedy choked them during the past 3 years. In addition, court records indicate that one child was allegedly duct-taped to a chair on at least one occasion as a form of punishment while having his or her mouth taped shut. Kennedy is scheduled for a January 15th hearing in Pottawatomie County Court. The arrest is unrelated to the murder investigation of Kimberly Ratliff, Kennedy's stepdaughter, who was found murdered inside a vehicle positioned along West Broadway in January 1999. Kennedy's son, Matt, was arrested in October and charged with first-degree murder. Matt Kennedy's jury trial is scheduled for February 2nd. You are listening to the Council Bluffs Nonpareil on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Wanda. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to today's obituaries. Mary Lorraine Dunn, age 91, passed away on December 7th at Methodist Jenny Edmondson Hospital from complications of COVID and pneumonia. She was born September 2nd, 1929, to the late Gus H. Nelson Sr. and M. Leona Nelson. In addition to her parents, she was also preceded in death by her son, Roger Dunn Sr., and brother, Gus H. Nelson Jr. Lorraine is survived by two daughters, Roxanne, husband Jim Wachter, and Ronelle, husband Randy Freeman, five grandchildren, 10 great-grandchildren, and a great-great-granddaughter. Lorraine retired in 1991 as director of the Lewis Central School Food Service Program. She was a lifelong member of Westminster Presbyterian Church. Lorraine loved to swim each week at the Senior Center. Some of her other many interests included traveling, painting birdhouses, sewing, and tending to her garden. Richard Tornenten, T-O-R-N-E-T-E-N, age 84, passed away peacefully December 22, 2020. He was born May 6, 1936, to the late Oscar and Ethel Tornenten in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Richard graduated from Underwood High School with the class of 54 and was a lifelong farmer. He was a member of St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Trainer and active in church council. He was involved at Westfair as the beef superintendent and on the sale committee. He also was a longtime member of the Pottawatomie Conservation Board and Bethany Lutheran Home Board. He was a tremendous supporter of the Underwood Community School. Richard is survived by his wife, Kathy Tornenten, daughter, Marcia, husband, Kevin Rath, son, Mark Tornenten, sisters, Marilyn, husband, Richard Formanek, and Jeanette, husband, Yui Melchow, grandchildren, Alexandra, spouse, Evelyn G. Shishkin, Emily Rath, Olivia Rath, Landon Tornetkin, and Ashlyn Tornetkin, a host of other family and friends. Visitation will be held at 8 a.m. to 12 p.m. at Hoy Kilnansky Funeral Home on Saturday, December 26th. Funeral service will be held at 12:30 p.m. at Hoy Kilnansky Funeral Home on Saturday, December 26, 2020. Internment at Cedar Lawn Cemetery. The family will direct memorials. William E. Stanford, age 66, passed away December 23, 2020 at CHI Mercy Hospital. Bill was born in Waterloo, Iowa on July 6, 1954, to Kenneth and Betty Stanford, and graduated from Thomas Jefferson High School in 1972. He retired from Omaha Standard Paul Finger Council Bluffs. Bill is preceded in death by his father, Kenneth, mother, Betty, brother, Thomas Stanford, sister, Deborah Becerra, and husband, Nathan, infant brother, Scott, niece, Josie Ramirez. Bill is survived by his brother, Terry Stanford, and his wife, Melody, sister-in-law, Angelina Stanford, of all of Council Bluffs, aunts, uncles, nieces, and nephews. Bill's wishes were to be cremated with no service. Sports. Michael Jordan's NASCAR team and its sponsors have a primary goal, diversity. Bubba Wallace is shown exercising alone in a dimly lit gym. The camera cuts to a small static screen in the corner as a news reporter's voice is heard saying, "Bubba Wallace asked for a ban on Confederate flags at NASCAR events." Wallace grinds through his workout, heaving and sweating as he crunches his body weight in what seems like a symbolic representation of his burden as the only black driver competing full-time in NASCAR's Top Series. Voices continue broadcasting headlines involving Wallace from this year, including references to a tweet issued by President Donald Trump, a Black Lives Matter car paint scheme, and a news incident some have labeled a hoax. Wallace is driving, it's raining. The commercial lasts for a pulsating 1 minute 17 seconds and reaches a climax when Wallace walks through a gaggle of reporters, a young Black fan looking on adoringly, and stops next to one who asks, "How do you respond to requests that you apologize?" Wallace's eyes flick to the camera, then back to the reporter, and he walks on. His response is silence. Then the words, "Progress owes no apology," flash on screen before the audience is hit with an inevitable promotion for auto insurance? What the? Proud to support unapologetic change. Proud to support Bubba Wallace, the tagline for the Root Insurance ad reads. The commercial dropped in October along with the announcement that the car insurance disruptor was partnering with Wallace to champion progress that is long overdue. Wallace called the ad toned down. It just shows where we need to go as a generation, where we need to go as a nation, to not make racism to where it is such an, "Ooh, I didn't want to touch that," Wallace said. These conversations need to be had. That's the problem. People don't want to talk about it because it doesn't affect them. At first glance, the campaign seems like a shock to NASCAR's system. The sport doesn't typically see new brands launching into sponsorship with an explicit stance on a polarizing topic. But this week, Root Insurance became one of five founding partners for Wallace's new Toyota team, 23XI Racing, co-owned by NBA legend Michael Jordan and three-time Daytona 500 winner Denny Hamlin. The company joined other IPO and stock market giants sponsoring the Cup Series team in its first season. Those sponsors include DoorDash, McDonald's, Columbia Sportswear, and Dr. Pepper, which are contributing to a fully funded first 2021 season with 23XI Racing. No sponsors shied away from Wallace's social activism in their announcements. As a company that values diversity, openness, and empowering local communities, we are proud to partner with 2311 Racing to build upon our shared foundation of creating a more inclusive environment for NASCAR fans. A statement from DoorDash Vice President of Marketing, Kofi Amu Gottfried, said. The company was expected to spend between $10 million and $15 million with Wallace's former Richard Petty Motorsports team and is likely investing in a similar range with 2311, according to Charlotte Business Journal. 2 years ago, McDonald's partnered with one of motorsports racing rising stars, Bubba Wallace, and we couldn't be more proud to witness him succeed on and off the track while breaking barriers and becoming one of the sport's truest change agents, McDonald's USA President Joe Erlinger said in a statement. As a founding partner of 23XI Racing, we're excited to continue our partnership with Bubba as he and the team advance the sport and make it more relevant to a larger audience. Wallace said the team sponsors share his goal for promoting diversity, inclusion, and equality. He said his talks with the brands, four of which had established relationships with Wallace before signing with the team, were about off-track stuff. The 23XI racing team said promoting diversity will be a goal internally as well. We raised our hand that we want to be right there alongside NASCAR with our partners trying to develop ways that more people can see NASCAR and the industry as a place to build that their career, gain experience, and we can become more inclusive as a sport. 23XI Racing President Steve Lauletta said. The team has been connecting with NASCAR's Diversity and Inclusion Office in order to consider more people of color for positions within the organization. NASCAR's Vice President of Diversity and Inclusion, Brandon Thompson, told the Charlotte Observer that his office has referred possible candidates to 23XI, although the team makes final decisions. He said the excitement around Jordan's entry into the sport has also generated more interest from potential applicants. Who wouldn't want to go work for Michael Jordan, right? Thompson said. There has already been an uptick in inquiries about this. Is the team hiring? And if we know about anything that comes open over there. Thompson, a graduate of NASCAR's diversity internship program, said his presence of the team will strengthen the already established internship pipeline for minorities in racing, especially on the corporate side. Although Thompson said he hasn't yet heard how many of his office recommendations have been hired, reports of diverse hires at 23XI have emerged. Craig John Robinson, a black motorsports marketer who works for Jordan's motorcycle racing team, was named director of partnership management at 23XI per Sports Business Journal. There is no metric in place currently for the number of diverse hires and NASCAR is encouraging teams to make, Thompson said. But that is a point they would one day get to. He also said the office isn't solely leaning on 23XI to be a target for its diversity pipeline. Right now, it's just more or less being intentional about that, Thompson said. Certainly, we have talked a lot about what we need to do to strengthen our recruitment practices, strengthen our retention practices, quite frankly, and any support programs we have around the company and in the industry to make sure we're supporting diverse talent throughout the sport. Thompson is one of 25 individuals from the diversity internship program working in the NASCAR industry. More than 400 students have participated in the program since its first year in 2000. Some graduates have gone on to work in other sports professions, but the momentum around 23XI could keep more in NASCAR. Industry-wide, I think there's just so much excitement around the team and Michael Jordan's involvement and Bubba being able to establish himself in a competitive ride, Thompson said. I think there's just a lot of general industry momentum behind that and excitement behind the team. Hamlin has already said he wants to expand the organization to a multi-car operation, and both he and Jordan have expressed their support for Wallace's social activism and the goal of promoting diversity in racing. Thompson said that Jordan has been in constant contact with NASCAR leadership and that it does not appear that he's going to be an absentee owner by any means, a promising sign that the team's goals will be met. Wallace didn't ask for all the popularity and eyes to be put on him, Hamlin said. It was because he's broken a lot of barriers within NASCAR racing, and so he feels this is something that he's passionate about. He wants to continue to break barriers within our sport, and it's up to me as the car owner to be supportive of that. If the momentum around 23XI continues, Wallace will be one of many making the conversation around race and social activism less taboo with greater corporate support. There's a lot of people like that inside the sport, outside the sport, just in the world, that are like, racism doesn't bother me. I don't care, Wallace said. If you respect me, if we're friends, if we're family, whatever, then it should affect you as the same way. Just as human beings, we want to step up and make sure that our brothers and sisters are looked out for. Stocks slightly higher on shortened trading day. Stocks were mildly higher on Christmas Eve morning trading, despite President Donald Trump's threat not to sign a major economic stimulus package approved by Congress this week. Trading was light as it is in an abbreviated trading session. Trading on the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ will end at 1 p.m. Eastern Time and will be closed Friday for Christmas holiday. The S&P 500 index was up 0.2% in trading, early trading, led higher by telecommunications and technology companies. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 52 points to 30,182, roughly 0.2% as well. The NASDAQ Composite was up 0.4%. Investors continue to turn their eyes to Washington, where Democrats in Congress is expected to try to make alterations to the $900 billion COVID stimulation bill that President Donald Trump has threatened to veto. Trump has asked for higher individual payments to Americans, include something Democrats seem to support, but is unlikely to get a vote in the Republican-held Senate. The hope has been that Trump will back away from his veto threat and the stimulus package might tide the economy over until widespread vaccinations can help the world begin to return to normal. Meanwhile, the U.S. economy continues to deteriorate under widespread coronavirus outbreaks, infections, and hospitalizations. The Labor Department said fewer U.S. workers filed for unemployment benefits last week. The number is still incredibly high compared with before the pandemic, but it was better than economists were expecting. Other reports were grimmer. Consumers pulled back on their spending by more last month than economists expected, mainly because of a drop in income. Despite the churning of the Washington, D.C. pond by voters, new votes, vetoes, new votes, and overrides, Wall Street clearly believes something positive will float to the top of the barrel when the churning stops, Jeffrey Haley of Oanda said in a commentary to investors. Next article. We are struggling. A bleak Christmas for America's jobless as pandemic won't relent. Last Christmas, Shanita Matthews cooked up a feast for her family of three: roast chicken, barbecue spare ribs, spinach, macaroni and cheese. This year, they'll stick with tuna fish and crackers, among the few items she can afford at the supermarket. "We're not really doing Christmas. I guess you can say it that way," said Matthews, who lives in Shawnee, Georgia. "We are struggling, we are tired, and all I have is my faith." Like nearly 10 million other Americans, Matthews has been jobless since the viral pandemic ripped through the U.S. economy in March, triggering a devastating recession and widespread unemployment. Now, many months later, they face a holiday season they hardly could have foreseen a year ago. Too little money to buy gifts, cook large festive meals, or pay all their bills. Nearly 8 million people have sunk into poverty since June, after having spent $1,200 checks that the government gave most Americans in the spring and a $600 a week supplemental jobless benefit expired in July, according to research by Bruce Meyer at the University of Chicago and two other colleagues. And finding a job is getting even harder. Hiring in November slowed for a fifth straight month, with U.S. employers adding the fewest jobs since April. Tips for making this year's holidays less wasteful. The holidays are so wasteful given all the commercialism and decorations. Do you have any tips for making this year's celebration less wasteful? This is for Earth Talk. The holidays are indeed a hugely wasteful time of year, but there are many ways we can reduce our impact and still enjoy this special season. Gift wrap is a great place to start. Much of the wrap we buy in stores can't be recycled because of its mixture of paper with glitter, plastic, dyes, laminate, and other materials. So it goes straight to the landfill after we use it once. Wrapping paper in brown grocery bags or parcel paper makes use of an everyday item that you may already have in your home while keeping your wrapping recyclable. Cut open paper bags from the grocery store, wrap up your presents like you would any other kind of paper, and tie it up with using recyclable twine, paper ribbon, or a shoelace. You can even put it back in the shoe later. To decorate your gifts, use stamps and leafy embellishments that make for a cute and sophisticated look. Go out into your neighborhood to forage for flowers or shoots of leaves to slip under your ribbon or twine. Another alternative to wrapping with brown paper is wrapping your gift with a scarf, two presents in one. The debate over which kind of Christmas tree, real or artificial, is better for the environment has been raging for a long time. But the real right answer is a live tree that you can plant in the ground outside after the holidays. If you decide to get a cut tree, look for one that's grown sustainably and pesticide-free. Going to the closest tree farm lowers the carbon footprint of buying a tree that was imported. If you want to get an artificial tree, most experts agree that you would need to reuse it for about 18 years to keep the environmental impact lower than that of a real tree. There are plenty of ways to decorate your home festively for the holiday season without being wasteful. First of all, if you already have decorations, use them. If you don't, try DIYing your decorations this year. You can use recycled paper or salt dough to make ornaments for your tree, and collect branches, holly, and leaves outside to create a wreath to hang on your door. Additionally, if you enjoy advent calendars for the month of December, try investing in a reusable wooden one this year, so you can fill it up with your own favorite treats, toys, and surprises for years to come. It's also important to be conscious consumers while we shop for holiday gifts. Be sure to think and think again before buying something this season. Try to buy long-term gifts and shop at small, sustainable, and/or local businesses to make your shopping greener. Etsy is a great place to find small businesses that sell ethical and sustainable products. Finally, if you enjoy unwrapping your creative side over the holidays, making your own gifts, upcycling thrifted clothes, jams, or chutneys, knitting, painting, pickling, or whatever you want to do is another way to reduce waste. Cheers for the holidays, and have a crafty one. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil. I'm your reader, Wanda. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays.
I'm getting older. Do I need to worry about falling?
Yes, you do. Every year, 1 in 4 people 65 and older will experience a fall, and many result in serious injury. The majority of falls happen at home. So take a look around. Replace bulbs and add lighting to help you see obstacles. Remove things that can make you trip. Fix uneven steps and floors, and install handrails in bathrooms and on stairs. Consider balance or strength training exercises, which can help with agility. Get your eyes and hearing checked regularly. Changes in your hearing can affect your balance. To learn more, please talk to your doctor about steps you can take to help prevent a fall. You can also visit aarpfoundation.org or medicaremadeclear.com/falls. This message was brought to you by United Healthcare and AARP Foundation.